Welcome to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast, part of the Center's efforts to cultivate dialogue about university teaching and learning among faculty, students, and staff. I'm your host, Derek Bruff, an assistant director at the Center for Teaching. In this episode, we feature an interview with Ellen Fanning, professor of biological sciences. In the interview, Ellen describes her methods of helping undergraduate biology students learn to read scientific literature, develop scientific reasoning skills, and gain an interest in science that lasts beyond their coursework. Ellen uses a journal club format that she has adapted from the one typically used with graduate students and postdocs to help her students explore current literature in the biological sciences. When I spoke with Ellen, she first described some of the courses in which she uses this undergraduate journal club format. These include an Introduction to Research course for first years and sophomores, in which they read historical papers, and a Capstone Special Topics course on viruses, in which juniors and seniors read about science in the news media before investigating primary literature on the topic. Ellen developed this journal club format while leading the Community of Scholars program here at Vanderbilt, a summer undergraduate research experience. Here's Ellen describing the journal club as it was developed for that context.
Can you kind of walk us through maybe the process as it started in the Community of Scholars or kind of as it developed there? Mm-hmm. And then we might talk about how you've modified it in some of these contexts.
Okay. We had initially proposed that the students were going to be doing research and understanding this conceptually. So we had to figure out a way to do this. And the sort of natural thing to do would be...
These are the students in the Community of Scholars program.
Right.
So they're undergraduates.
Undergraduates who are starting research, never done it before in most cases. More advanced undergraduates who had done some research, but probably had not had the right exposure yet to reading primary literature. Graduate students who were learning how to mentor and how to teach, and junior and senior faculty, postdocs as well, of course. And so the idea was to have a journal club. But of course what happened was, whoever was presenting the journal club, the paper, which is normally done by a single person, was sort of showering this out upon this diverse community of learners, and they were sort of letting it wash over them and getting up and going away, not having even understood enough to feel comfortable asking a question. Maybe the graduate students or other postdocs, faculty would ask questions, but this wasn't really kind of the experience that we wanted. We were frustrated with it, and the students, particularly the beginners, oh, here we go again, we have to do this journal club. And so we brainstormed about what we could do to get people involved, and we reasoned that we had to break them up into smaller groups and had to get down to the nitty-gritty in some way. So that was the way that we started, by assigning groups of people from different labs with different subject knowledge at different levels of expertise to all work together with, including the beginners, to present one figure.
One figure or one
paper?
One
figure.
One figure from one paper.
From one paper. And then successively each figure would be presented by the entire group.
So you would have a small group devoted to each figure.
Yes.
And between and across the entire group, you would eventually look at all the figures in
yes.
the paper.
Okay. So let's say there's six figures in the paper. We had six small groups, and you know, like up to maybe 8 or 10 people in each group, some juniors, some seniors, some totally beginners, and from different. And the papers were of general interest for this broad community of researchers, actually, or would-be researchers. So that seemed to work pretty well. The first few times we did it, it took a huge amount of time, like the better part of an afternoon with cookies and whatnot. But it was also, of course, a social occasion then, where people from different labs could get to know each other. It had all kinds of...
So would they do any preparation work before they came together?
They didn't initially.
Okay.
That's a very perceptive question. Yes, they didn't initially, and that was part of why it took so long. And so...
So they would walk in and you would say, here's today's paper.
No, they had read the... They had
read the paper.
Yes. They had had the paper for a week. But they hadn't done necessarily any work on how they would explain it to anybody. So then we built in another layer where having looked at the paper, they were assigned to, with their one-on-one research mentor, which also was good for the graduate students, to work with the beginners and work through the paper. And we found that, in fact, sometimes the graduate students had not understood the paper enough to be able to explain it later in this journal club community atmosphere. So that worked both ways, again, so that everybody came in with at least some understanding. They didn't know which figure they were going to get still, but they had
done the preparation. They had read the paper, and they had met with
their mentor
or mentee to discuss
One or two or three people together, really bashing it ahead of time. And then when everyone came together, it was a little more fluid, and people were feeling much more comfortable. It turned out to be extremely useful in ways that we hadn't anticipated as well. We had several students who were just very bashful about standing in front of people and speaking. We had one particular case of a very smart student, gifted in many interesting ways. She was so bashful that she stood in front of the group. That was all she could manage, is to go up with the rest of her group and stand there with them. And eventually she got to the point where she could say a few words. The whole room cheered when she did. And things developed from there. She just finished her last undergraduate research and presents now her research at the end of the semester to the faculty, just like everybody else. So that was good. And then the fact that we had so many different sort of fields of research working on intertwined subjects and doing these papers led to lots of conversations among the faculty and postdocs, and they started doing research collaborations. So it's been a very beneficial experience from multiple viewpoints, I think.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit more? This diversity element is pretty interesting, that you have people not only at different levels of expertise, but from different subfields coming together to make sense of something together. Is that challenging? Is that... how does that work? Because I think there is a challenge there.
Yes, there's definitely a challenge there, because everyone's sort of outside their comfort level at some point over this experience, in that case, like a summer. and all of us know how difficult it is to understand something from someone else's point of view. For example, I had started a collaboration with a structural biologist, NMR spectroscopist, biophysics. Very biophysics. And my background was in biochemistry, molecular genetics, biology more. And we spoke for the longest time one-on-one, sort of broadcasting over each other's head, and every time we would get together again, we had to go over it again because it wouldn't stick. We didn't have the coat hangers in the brain to make it stick. But having gone through several papers that were familiar to one of us or the other of us, and having to actually bash the paper with each other's postdocs and students in this kind of setting and be able to explain it, it led to a much more sort of natural way of considering each other's viewpoint. And now the collaboration has developed to the point where I can know where his problems are going to be, and he can know where my problems are going to be, and it just smooths a communication that was disconnected before, I think. Yeah, so the diversity is a challenge in interdisciplinary work, so this is a good way to go about it, not asking somebody to understand your stuff, or you asking that someone else to understand your own stuff. It's more like a commonly directed effort to understand something that may not be even familiar to either of you, and creating some understanding where there wasn't any. So is that
I think so. Yeah, to the point it sounds like part of the challenge is in picking papers that address topics that will lead to that.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
I'm also guessing that part of the one element was the fact that there were people in the room with different levels of expertise. And so knowing that you've got a freshman or a sophomore in the room changes how you approach your explanation of the diagram, of the figure.
True. That's also
true. So
it's
about explaining, which is a nice lead-in to understanding, I think.
Yes. I think a common experience among everyone who teaches is that you don't really understand anything until you can explain it to someone who hasn't encountered it before.
So this started in these summer experiences, mm-hmm. and then as you've indicated, you now use something similar in these various courses at the undergraduate and graduate level.
Right.
What kind of changes have you had to make for it to work, let's say with the freshman sophomore seminar on research?
I think the main change that we make to in the one-on-one setting, which is the sort of the pattern for this, it's a tutorial type course with weekly meetings, initially scheduled to be an hour, but they change, is to limit how much material you cover, because the challenge for the student is really to learn the method, how to approach this problem. And so it's not about content, and ordinarily they're going to be fixed on content. Learning something that they can spit back, that's what they're sort of conditioned to expect. And learning for understanding, learning to puzzle through things and satisfy yourself that you understand it, is where we're trying to go with it. And so doing it slowly and in detail, asking questions. Part of it is Socratic, of course. Well, now, why wouldn't you do this? Or couldn't you have done that? Can you think of any way they could have asked that question? That's a very interesting question. Now, how would you address that? And so on. So that gets them into thinking mode rather than the absorption mode that most of our undergraduates tend to operate in.
And so there, I assume that the nature of the papers is a little bit different as well.
No, not really.
Do you still do the small groups on different figures?
No. If it's a class, let's say with up to somewhere between 12 and 15 students, it depends. I've gone away from doing the group thing because the group in class time, because the group doesn't really have enough time to puzzle through it together. They have to do it ahead of time, which means they have to be assigned which figure they're going to do. They're still supposed to read the entire paper. From the questions that are asked, you can see that people have struggled with understanding it. And they only begin to ask questions like, we're now about a third through this course that I'm teaching this way, this semester. And the class is only now just becoming comfortable enough with each other that they can identify without threatening the person who's presenting questions about it. And it's different for each person, how long it takes for them to feel comfortable with it. I have one who may never feel comfortable with it right now.
And is the challenge there that the students don't feel comfortable questioning in a way that would be taken as a critique?
Yes.
Of their peers?
Yes.
Yeah.
They don't want to do that. And they don't want it to happen to them either. So there's a lot of pressure. We're coming up on our first exam today. And I have never seen students feel so pressured as they do at the first exam in a course like this, because they don't know what, can we have a practice test? No, you cannot have a practice test. I want you to think what concepts you think are important And so they all had to email me paragraphs about their concepts. We discussed those on Tuesday. And now, off the record, that's what the exam's going to be about. So they actually have identified it themselves. This is an evolution, I think.
But that's a big break from the absorption model you were
Absolutely.
Talking about before.
Absolutely.
Where not only are they, is the goal not to just memorize some things and give it back to you, right? You want to see some conceptual understanding, you want to see some thinking, some reasoning.
Right.
But you're not setting the agenda in the same way that you would be if you were doing the absorption model.
True. I'm setting the agenda in terms of the subject matter. I'm picking the papers because I think they show something that is worth learning. But they still have to puzzle through it to learn it. I'm not handing it to them.
You're putting more responsibility on them to decide what's important, what's not as important, what's relevant.
Right. And I guess this is a step beyond where we were when we developed the journal club model. You can see the anxiety among the students until they figure out that this is actually not threatening to them, but we'll get there.
How do the students react down the road after they've been in this environment for a little while?
Oh, by the end of the course, they absolutely love it. And there's such flexibility to use the different skills that the different students have. We had one graduate student from Peabody in this course a year ago, and he was totally anxious at the beginning because he didn't have background that the other ones had. Now he sends me emails every now and then about important educational things that he's using that are online that I should have a look at. As his thesis project, he's developing a classroom exercise in viruses and teaching students biology by using viruses. I haven't heard, you know, all that much about it, but it sounds very intriguing.
Which course was he in?
He was in this virology.
The upper level
yeah. course.
Yeah. So he had a voice, he had a role to play in that classroom that he found.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And he used it, he leveraged it then to create his own new thing. So that's always fun to see what they do with it. A bunch of them have, after they've left Vanderbilt, they're generally med school bound, or they take off a year and do something useful to prepare themselves for medical school. And very often I get emails from people, oh, did you see this new thing on the BBC? Here it is, here's the link, or whatever, about viruses. And public health becomes a big issue for most of them, having learned about viruses. They can relate to new and emerging viruses they're concerned about. Prevention, all kinds of.
So it sounds like not only have they developed an interest on some level in viruses, but they've also developed the ability to continue to learn about viruses.
That's the key piece, is that they have the skills now to find out and piece together for themselves whatever they want to know. And whether that's just about viruses, I hope not. I don't know that, but I think it's a transferable skill. They're also recommending their younger brothers and sisters to sit in the same course.
So. Great. Well, that's a good sign, too. Any other comments? Any other thoughts on...
Well, the main thing that I think was beneficial to me about developing this was just the realization that conceptual learning is generally, in our old-fashioned education, the way that we were taught, more an accident than intentional. And that it is possible to design your teaching in a way that it is intentional, that conceptual learning comes about. One thing. Second thing, I do not like lecturing anymore at all. I've never been particularly a fan of it. And it makes good sense, I think, in terms of like giving seminars to a research community who is interested in a particular subject. But it isn't really a good way to teach. And even though that's the way everyone was taught, it isn't necessary to just repeat it. And it's a whole lot more fun. Because you don't know what's going to happen. It keeps you on your toes. It keeps everybody who's involved, first of all, involved and on their toes, open, perceptive. If only because they're so anxious.
But as you say, as the students progress through this and have more experience with it,
they gain confidence.
They gain confidence. They're being equipped with skills,
yes,
that they can use,
yes,
and an interest in things that maybe they didn't know they,
right,
might be interested in.
And then they're not so self-conscious about themselves. They're working together on the problem.
That was Ellen Fanning, professor of biological sciences, describing her use of an undergraduate journal club. I'd like to thank Ellen for taking time to speak with me. In the show notes for this episode, you'll find links to Ellen Fanning's lab homepage, the Community of Scholars homepage, and the Center for Teaching's online resources on motivating students. If you have any comments or questions about this episode, please visit our blog, located at blogs.vanderbilt.edu/CFTpodcast, and let us know your thoughts. Vanderbilt instructors interested in discussing any aspect of their teaching are invited to call the Center for Teaching at 322-7290 to arrange a meeting with a CFT teaching consultant. We're glad to help you reflect on and explore the various choices you make as a teacher and to connect you with resources you'll find useful as you design, implement, and assess learning experiences for your students. I've been your host, Derek Bruff. Thanks for listening.